Most glorious night, thou wert not sent for slumber. If Lord Byron were alive today, I'm pretty sure he'd say, most glorious night, thou wert sent for listening to Coast to Coast. Welcome to the night. Welcome to Coast. My name is Richard Serrett, and we're broadcasting live from Toronto, Canada, along the shores of Lake Ontario and the studios of AM 640 Coast's Toronto affiliate. And if Lord Byron, the great English poet, were alive today, I'm pretty sure he'd be cheering for Greece in the World Cup. Byron absolutely loved Greece, lived a good part of his life there. In fact, he died there. He fought for Greece during their war of independence from the Turks. And when Byron died at the age of 36 in 1824, his body was shipped back to his native England, preserved in a 180-gallon cask of rum. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't mind checking out that way myself. Tonight, this morning, Coast comes to you, as I say, live from Toronto, Canada, along the shores of Lake Ontario, and we've got a great show for you. But first, I want to draw your attention to the Coast to Coast website, where our webmaster tonight, Sean Lauder, is busy posting some great stories. In fact, if it's not up already in just a short while, it will be. And this is a video of featuring our guest in hours 2, 3, and 4 tonight, Dr. William Pollock, who will be discussing the healing technologies of Nikola Tesla. And in fact, there's an interesting festival coming to Toronto in July. I think you should know about it. It's a festival and exposition celebrating the visions, inventions, and life of the brilliant, eccentric Serbian-American inventor Nikola Tesla. It's called Tesla Mania. And we'll get more details on that later during, as I say, hours 2, 3, and 4, when we'll examine the healing technologies of this brilliant Serbian-American. To describe Nikola Tesla as a brilliant inventor is a little like saying, I don't know, Brooks Robinson was a fairly good third baseman. His brilliance was almost otherworldly. It was almost as if Tesla received his information from the future. Tesla, of course, developed the alternating current electrical system, which is still widely used today, and he discovered the rotating magnetic field, the basis of most AC machinery. He designed the first hydroelectric power plant at Niagara Falls, and of course, most of us are familiar with the Tesla coil, which is used to produce high voltage and low current, high frequency alternating current electricity. And he used these coils to conduct innovative experiments in electrical lighting, phosphorescence, X-ray generation, high-frequency alternating current phenomena, electrotherapy, and the transmission of electrical energy without wires. Imagine generating electricity without all those ugly overhead transmission wires, which are very wasteful and a very inefficient way of bringing electricity into our homes and factories. Back in the early 1900s, Tesla was squirreled away in his lab in Shoreham, Long Island, where he built his Wardenclyffe Tower facility from which he intended to transmit electricity through the air. But, not surprisingly, his financiers at Morgan Stanley pulled his funding. I guess they figured out that if you can transmit electricity through the air, it would be essentially free. How could you meter it? How would you bill for it? And as a result, the generation of electricity, or the generation of electricity as we know it, has really not changed very much over the last century, which is pretty confounding when you consider things like Moore's Law. But tonight, while the subject of Tesla coils will undoubtedly come up, we're going to focus on another aspect of the great futurist and inventor's legacy, the healing power of electromagnetic field pulse therapy. At the turn of the 20th century, the use of electrotherapy was pretty popular. Tesla had invented alternating current electricity and was teaching electricians how to use it to treat serious diseases, improve memory, enhance the growth of bones, muscle, even to increase IQ. In 1910, the U.S. and Canadian medical boards decided to prohibit the teaching of electrotherapy in medical schools and announced that pharmaceuticals and surgery would be the preferred method of healthcare. Doctors that practiced electromedicine were considered quack doctors, and they were gradually forced out of business. Now we fast forward to the 21st century, and here in Canada, Health Canada is licensing pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. And tonight, as I say, we'll be joined by Dr. William Pollack, a national expert in the medical use of electromagnetics and energy medicine for more than 22 years. But first, the latest horror show playing out in Iraq, of course, is this band of ultra-extremist jihadists who are rampaging across the Fertile Crescent and killing and beheading just about anyone that gets in their way. In fact, you don't even have to be in their way. Since capturing Iraq's second city of Mosul on June the 10th, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, has marched south towards Baghdad, seizing a number of towns, military bases, and resource-rich assets on the way. But what is this group's long-term game plan? What will this militant group of Sunni Muslims that even Al-Qaeda won't have anything to do with, what are they up to? Even Al-Qaeda considers ISIS to be too extreme. Now, this has led to a lot of powerful people in Washington to start clamoring for a Gulf War reboot. People like former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney writing an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal saying President Obama never should have ended the war in Iraq. There's a BBC report out where ISIS is being described as the wealthiest militant organization in the world. It controls large swaths of territory stretching from eastern Syria to northern Iraq. But the question remains, where did ISIS come from? What exactly do they hope to accomplish? And more importantly, who is behind them? Webster Griffin Tarpley is an historian, author, and pretty incisive critic of American foreign policy. Republicans, Democrats, doesn't matter. He goes after them both. He's about to join us with his take on what ISIS is all about. And again, the all-important question, who's behind it and what he has to say, is pretty controversial, pretty contentious, and quite frankly, pretty damn jarring. You know, sometimes on this program, we tell stories that aim for your head, your mind. Sometimes we aim for your heart. Once in a while, a story must be told that slams you right in the gut. ISIS, Iraq, and what the CIA might have to do with all this. When Coast to Coast continues, I'm Richard Serrett. Welcome back to Coast, Richard Serrett with you. Webster Griffin Tarpley is one of the most incisive critics of Anglo-American hegemony. As an active historian, he's best known for his book, George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, widely considered a masterpiece of research, which is still a must-read. He's written a number of other compelling and controversial books, including 9/11, Synthetic Terror Made in the USA, Just Too Weird, Bishop Romney and the Mormon Takeover of America, Polygamy, Theocracy, and Subversion, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, and Obama, The Postmodern Coup. Webster Griffin Tarpley, how are you, sir?
Good evening, Richard. How are you?
Very well. You know, it's kind of propitious that we're speaking tonight. Here we are, the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and the Duchess, Sophia, I believe. The shot that began World War I, 100 years ago today.
Yes, and it's good to remember that strange atmosphere of July 1914, because the way it happened was you had this group of Serbian terrorists from an organization called the Black Hand who killed these two royals from the House of Habsburg. But then there's a period of 30 days, an entire month, when for most people, nothing happens. They don't really see anything moving. Most of the diplomatic traffic and threats and so forth going on is all secret. So people actually don't know. There are some things that they do know, right? There's an ultimatum by Austria to Serbia saying, you have to let us come in and investigate this, and we're going to, you know, investigate it our way and not, you know, not listen to you. But for most people, it's June 28th, an assassination, then a few ripples or more. And then on July 28th, the declarations of war start. And it's good to remember that the British were the first to mobilize their fleet, not their armies, but certainly their fleet. And one of the interesting things about this is that this is all planned, right? I think for the Coast to Coast audience, it's important to remember that this the entire outbreak of World War One was planned essentially by British and French Freemasonic lodges, the so-called Grand Orient. And one of the interesting books about this is a guy called Clarence Henry Norman, who wrote in the 1920s a book called A Searchlight on the European War. And what he tells you is that on June 28th, 1914, which was a Sunday, he was going around downtown London and going to newspaper offices, because that's where he worked. And when he got into the Strand, right, big boulevard in London, a guy comes up to him and says, "Have you got any news from Sarajevo? Have you got any news from Sarajevo?" And he has to say, "What? What are you talking about? What's Sarajevo?" And the guy tells him, "Sarajevo, it's a city in Bosnia, right? It's a city in this contested archduchy." And I don't know, he says. And by this time, it's getting to be almost noon. And then the guy says he mumbles, this guy who's asking him, says, "Is it possible that they blew it, that they screwed up? What could that mean?" And then later on, he goes to the home of a friend who works for the Northcliffe newspapers, right? There's a huge British newspaper chain at the time. And there's by this time, the news has come in that the assassinations have occurred. And the lady, the hostess of this afternoon tea that he's going to attend, says, I'm sorry, some of the people who you thought were going to be here have already left. I had to go back to their offices to work on the extras, right, the special editions of their newspapers." And she said, "By the way, what we had just now was a signal for the big European war, which Northcliffe newspapers had wanted." So and that the idea that this was going to become a European war was a minority opinion, but basically very, very few people thought it was going to be that. And of course, Otto von Bismarck, right, the guy who united Germany some decades before this, had always said, "I can't tell you when the war is going to start, but I can tell you where, and it will start as some stupid thing in the Balkans." Well, in this case, I'm afraid it's these British Freemasons. And the reason they were able to do this was that in the decades before 1914, up to 1910, we had one of the most remarkable kings of England is Edward the VII, right, the son of Queen Victoria, who had to wait for so long until his eternal mother finally passed away and he could become king. He only got to be king for about 10 years. But during the time that he was Prince of Wales and then as monarch, he assembled this alliance system. In other words, the Triple Entente, right, the encirclement of Germany and indeed of Austria. So England plus France plus Russia, with Japan acting as a de facto ally out in the Far East against Russia and against Germany, ironically. He's the architect of that. And then, of course, the other side tries to fight back with the Triple Alliance, but that is Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. Of course, Italy drops out, and then they're replaced by Turkey, by the Ottoman Empire. But once you had that mechanism set up, any incident was going to turn into a general European war. In other words, because of the mobilization plans of the armies, right? If a war started, France had to mobilize immediately, Germany had to mobilize, and Russia had to mobilize. And as soon as any of them started to mobilize, that meant war. Mobilization was war in those days. So it meant if you could just get an incident, then the entire world was going to blow up. And the reason the British were concerned, of course, was that they saw they were being overtaken by Germany in production, in military power, in political influence, and so forth. And we can maybe think a little bit about this today. The U.S. ruling class, the Wall Street financial oligarchs, these people are obsessed with the idea that they're losing control of the world. They feel that they're challenged by Russia militarily and politically, by China economically. And we have here in Washington, I would call it a collective psychosis. It's a war psychosis where these people are looking for ways to strike back at Putin, at Assad, at Iran, at China, and so forth. And I have to pose the question, are we living in a kind of a long July 1914? Right? The people who wrote novels and memoirs about this after the fact are pretty much in agreement that this was a dream time. It was a world of absolute illusion. There's a new book about this called The Sleepwalkers, right? That Europe sleepwalked into World War One. Well, I would say that's really not true, that there was a group of British Freemasons who did want war, and they basically said, we've got to settle accounts with Germany now, because otherwise they get more powerful every year and we get weaker. And I think that's sort of what people like Kerry or Rice think about Russia, China, right? The BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Well, Webster, what will be our Sarajevo if we're drawing parallels between 1914 and 2014? What will be our Sarajevo? Is it the road to World War III? Is it Crimea? Is it Ukraine? Or is it the Fertile Crescent?
It will have to be something more shocking than that and more surprising. Now, I hope, thanks to the efforts of the 9/11 Truth Movement and people who have also worked on the Kennedy and King and other assassinations, that there's a greater degree of skepticism in the world about this. And I think you've also got the propaganda establishments, especially of Russia, but also of others, who are, I think, generally speaking, aware of this problem. So there will be another interpretation offered. But I would urge people to take that very seriously. If you look at World War One, we're still living in the wreckage of World War One. Look what came out of it, right? Fascism, first of all, and then Nazism out of that, and then on the other side, communism, and then the Second World War, the Cold War, and really that takes us up to only yesterday. And the costs, Germany was paying reparations into the 1990s, even though they had been radically cut down. So when you look at a place like Ukraine, right, when you look at that government, which I consider fascist, right, those people in Kiev who have, you know, taken over the government with a coup in February, and now they've had a kind of an election, which was really not much of an election. Are we supposed to be wanting to risk our lives and the civilization as we've known it for the ambitions of a bunch of political adventurers like Poroshenko, the chocolate king in Kiev? I really don't think so. And you look at NATO, right? Look at NATO having been pushed right up to the front door of Russia, right? Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and now a desire by many neocons, but also these humanitarian bomber types that we have, to push it right up to Ukraine and Georgia and Moldavia and so forth. Doesn't that begin to look like these 1914 alliances? Where
right. I mean, how would the United States feel if, let's say, the Russians were to put missiles in, oh, I don't know, Cuba? Wait a minute. We've seen this movie before. Webster Tarpley is with us. Listen, I want to focus on Iraq now, because
sure.
I called it the latest horror show. This ISIS a group of rampaging jihadists, we're told, taking control of Mosul and some fairly significant resource rich assets in northern Iraq. I want to talk about, you know, where they came from and who is really behind them. Let's first start off with the supposed leader of ISIS, this guy Baghdadi. Who is Baghdadi?
Yeah, look, Baghdadi is one of a whole group of people who have passed through the United States prisoner of war system, be it in Guantanamo, be it in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and come out of it not themselves, or at least retooled, reconfigured, redirected. And in particular, I think it ought to be clear to people, the way you get out of a U.S. prisoner of war camp, the way you get out of Guantanamo, is you get brainwashed or you become a double agent for the U.S. And we've seen it, right? We've seen people coming from Guantanamo, going back to Libya, and all of a sudden their purpose in life is to bring down Gaddafi, which hadn't been their goal before, but that's the U.S. goal. And similarly, going back to Yemen, another guy went back to Yemen, and the big thing was to overthrow the government of Yemen. So it's a funny kind of Al-Qaeda. They're not interested in attacking the U.S. so much. They want to attack the Arab governments. And that's Baghdadi. Baghdadi, I like to say he has a four-year diploma. He's got a four-year degree. He's been in U.S. prisoner of war camps for 4 years, from 2005 to 2009. And out of that, he got the idea that it was necessary to build up this organization that's called ISIS, right? The Islamic Emirate of Iraq and Sham, or Syria, or the Levant.
Okay, Webster, I've got to jump in here. We'll take a timeout. We'll continue on the other side as we discuss ISIS and Iraq. Webster Griffin Tarpley, my guest. Richard Serrett sitting in on Coast to Coast. Stay a while. That sunny song, sort of sharp in sharp contrast to the subject matter as we discuss ISIS, this rampaging group of extremist jihadists rampaging across Iraq. And the question on everyone's mind is, what will this militant group do next? And will this provide the pretext for a reboot of the Gulf War? Will this escalate and lead to more boots on the ground in Iraq? We'll get into that, as well as an interesting article that ran some time ago, actually, in Der Spiegel magazine, the German magazine, which quoted Jordanian officials who say that members of ISIS, the same group now rampaging in Iraq, were trained at a secret base in Jordan by U.S. military personnel. Perish the thought. Back with more of my conversation with Webster Tarpley here on Coast to Coast. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard Serrett with you. Webster Tarpley joining us as we discuss ISIS in Iraq. I mentioned this Der Spiegel magazine article actually dates back to about 2012, Webster, and the article quotes Jordanian officials saying that members of ISIS were trained in a secret base in Jordan by U.S. military personnel. What can you tell me about that story?
Well, I can tell you that this has now been confirmed on the front page of the Washington Post yesterday, Friday, June 27th. And this is now Obama coming forward to demand $500 million in direct U.S. military training and equipment for the so-called Syrian opposition. If we read the Washington Post article, we see in the second paragraph, money for the assistance would expand a CIA covert operations training program, and it's included in a bill, and the training would take place in Jordan, where the CIA is currently training Syrian opposition forces, and possibly in Turkey. So the basic contention is that ISIS is largely a product of this advanced guerrilla Mujahideen training school that the U.S., Britain, France, NATO in general have had going in Jordan. And of course, that's they can't say, you know, this is a school for jihadis and Mujahideen and takfiris. That's a good term for them, right? The holier than thou's, right? If you don't agree with me, says the takfiri, you're a heretic, right? If you're you claim to be a Muslim, but if you're not my kind of Muslim, then I get to behead you. That's the ISIS point of view. So those ranks have been filled with trainees by the U.S., and they've been given weapons. Now, the money is thought to come from Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of control coming from Prince Abdul Rahman Faisal. He's the brother of the foreign minister, Saud al-Faisal. He's also the brother or half-brother, since they all come out of a harem, hard to keep track of. But he's the brother then of the former ambassador to London and to Washington, Prince Turki al-Faisal, T-U-R-K-I. So that's what you're dealing with. That's ISIS. In other words, it's led by a brainwashed double agent, I guess we can say, coming out of this four-year incarceration by the U.S., and we got to remember, that's what Guantanamo is. It's a training school within a concentration camp. But then the people have been trained, and there are inputs coming from Turkey. Now, if you tell this to the State Department, they're going to say, oh, no, we only deal with the vetted moderate opposition. Well, the story now is there is no more vetted opposition, moderate opposition. I don't think there ever was, but certainly there's nowhere to find it now. What used to be called the Free Syrian Army, led by General Salim Idris, has simply melted away. They're all gone. Idris himself is thought to be in one of the Gulf states. His second and third in command are in Sweden and in the Netherlands. So they're just gone. There is no such thing.
And so is this, Webster, like is this Kerry, a situation? Is this a situation where, again, it's Frankenstein's monster run amok? The ISIS band was trained in Jordan as part of the Free Syrian Army, but then something went, I don't know, totally awry, and now they've turned into this band of rampaging lunatics. I mean, surely you're not suggesting that they were trained in Jordan to perform such horrific acts as beheading. Now they're talking about, you know, kidnapping Kurdish children and perhaps even beheading them. I mean, this is just beyond the pale.
But this is the revolving door was always that. Everybody knew that if you trained a jihadi, he might go into the ranks of the Free Syrian Army for a while, but then he would soon go with his weaponry into the more extreme Nusra Islamic Front. And in this case, the one with the most ideological appeal and the most money, right? Everybody, you've been talking about that before, right? They took money from the Iraqi Central Bank, but they've always been rolling in dough. They get it from Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And the goal of all this is the destruction of the modern state. I would really urge people who go around spouting anti-government slogans, take a look at the fact that the CIA policy worldwide is to break up every existing nation state, right? They've done it with Czechoslovakia. They've done it with Serbia, right? The secession or the departure of Kosovo. Sudan has been cut into two parts. That was a British project that lasted about 100 years. And what we're seeing now is the final breakup of Iraq into three parts, right? The Kurds, the Sunni entity, and then the Shiistan down there on the lower Euphrates, right? Baghdad and south. And the goal is to destroy Iraq, in this case, as a modern state. There are similar plans for Iran, for Pakistan. The British, they have this method of using themselves as the pilot project. In other words, they want to have Friedmanite, monetarist economics, right? Severe austerity. They put Thatcher into power in Britain, and then that gets imitated by somebody like Reagan. So that's how they do it, and that's what they're doing today with Scotland, right? The idea that Scotland could become an independent country. It's absurd. They won't be independent. They'll have the Queen and the Bank of England, and they'll have the IMF and so forth. And they'll also have the European Commission and the European Central Bank. But
except once you release this monster that is ISIS, how do you control them? And are they still being controlled on the ground in Iraq?
Well, right now, I think they are controlled to some degree. But here's a very interesting person warning now. Rouhani, right, the new president of Iran, right, the moderate, put out a warning to the Saudi royal family saying essentially, you are playing with fire. You think you control these people. That you think they're going to come up to the Saudi border? They're almost at the Saudi border in a number of places. You think they're going to stop just because it's your border and you paid them? No. Because remember, the average rank and file mujahideen, he doesn't know that, right? He believes the rhetoric and the ideology, right? So he's anxious to go and crucify and behead the non-believers. The danger, of course, is that it then does get out of control, right? And you can think of Christopher Marlowe's play Tamerlane, where the guy starts off with 100 or 200 followers, and pretty soon he's got 150,000 or even 2 million. What it also shows is the way the Roman Empire actually fell. Right? It takes us all the way back to the 400s and 500s. Because in those days, you'd had Rome in Italy, and then you had Constantinople over there in on the border of Asia. And there was a kind of a diplomatic contest. When somebody like Attila the Hun showed up, there would be emissaries from the Byzantine Empire saying, don't bother us. We're really poor. We're not worth taking. Go to Rome. And Rome, of course, reciprocated, please. We're just, you know, poor relations here. The big money is in Byzantium. And then it got more active than that. But you get the idea, right? That,
right.
That the,
where
the
is this headed, though?
The forces of civilization connive at their own destruction.
Is this about regime change in the immediate future? Is this about getting rid of Prime Minister Maliki, who is seen as being perhaps not able to sort of hold Iraq together as a cohesive unit, and he's seen
yes,
as
course.
Being... Okay, so it's about getting rid of Maliki. Is this insurgency, if I can call it that, it's a bloodbath is what it is, but is it intended to provide the pretext for U.S. NATO boots on the ground in Iraq?
It might, but I think it's a little bit more complicated. The first step is that they want Maliki out, the U.S. and the British and NATO, they want Maliki out because he's pro-Iranian. He's very close to the Iranian government. He's become more so, right? He wanted the U.S. out. He represents a kind of Iraqi nationalism left over after the Saddam Hussein regime. So that's number one. They also want Assad out. In other words, all you're seeing is the same method used by the U.S. and the British against Assad with these death squads. This has now been exported across the border into Iraq, which is actually where it started, right? Because the death squads you see attacking Assad today in Syria were the ones that were started up under Negroponte when he was the U.S. ambassador, 10 years ago. And Ambassador Ford, who was in Syria until a short time ago, he had learned his trade under Negroponte in Iraq. So these are jihadi groups that were then sent from Iraq to Syria, and now they're coming back, but they're coming back beefed up with all those people coming out of those Jordanian camps with all that Saudi money and with all the modern weaponry they could buy. So the essential program is down with Assad, says Washington, down with Maliki. They do have their candidates, this guy Alawi, who's a classic U.S. puppet. They want him in. And then they want to cause trouble for Iran, right? If you listen to McCain says, start bombing immediately, and then start bombing Syria immediately. Bomb into Syria, and if you hit Hezbollah or if you hit the Iranians that are helping Assad in Syria, who cares? It doesn't matter. And you can see that McCain, I think, looks at bombing as something that could easily go across the border into Iran. And then you're dealing with a huge regional war. There's also this charming lady, Anne Marie Slaughter. What a name, you might say. Well, yes, her name is her program. Anne Marie Slaughter had been in the State Department. She's very prominent. She writes op-eds all the time. And her line is, your main enemy is Putin, but Putin is too strong to attack in Ukraine. Better to attack Putin in Syria, because that's where he's weaker. And you try to inflict a defeat on Putin in Syria. So that's also what's happening. But remember, the actual goal is the destruction of the modern state. So again, if you go around spouting anti-big government and down with the government and all this stuff, you have to ask yourself, are you not playing into the hands of the CIA? There's also a compendium of this stuff. It's called the Bernard Lewis Plan. If you look in the internet, put in Bernard Lewis Plan, you may find a map that I put up there a while ago, which essentially shows some of the carving that they want to do. They want to take every country in the Middle East and cut it into pieces. And it doesn't stop there. It goes to Europe, and God knows it also comes to North America, right? They've been working on that for decades.
The other person who's being touted as a potential candidate to replace al-Maliki is Ahmad Shalabi, who we've heard his name before. He's the former head of the Iraqi National Congress, which has been described as a CIA-funded Iraqi exile group, and they were the ones that strongly pushed for the 2003 U.S. campaign.
That's right. Don't buy any used cars from that guy, right? Because he's, they had two people. They had Source Curveball, who's a separate person, and then Shalabi. And he was then trotted out by Cheney and the neocons, who kept saying, you know, this is going to be a cakewalk. We're going to be hugged and kissed and showered with flowers as liberators. But look, the one coup that we didn't mention is the coup against Obama. And you mentioned this before, this article by Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney, right? Here we are in the Wall Street Journal, June 18th, The Collapsing Obama Doctrine by Liz Cheney and his daughter, by Liz Cheney with some help from Dick Cheney, I guess, right? In the hours that he was awake. And here we have that Obama is a fool, that Obama is throwing away, he squanders American freedom, he betrays the American past. I read that as a call for a coup against Obama, and there's no secret about it. The coup is what McCain has called for on the floor of the Senate. He said Obama has to fire everybody he's got in the State Department and the National Security Council. The so-called National Security Team has got to be fired, says McCain, and he wants to bring in General David Petraeus of the CIA and the Pentagon, the man who embodies, in my view, has embodied now for quite a few years, the notion of an authoritarian government here in the United States. You can call
but
it
you're not talking about a. You're not talking about a coup d'etat like we see in places like Honduras or Egypt. We're talking about
a
far more sophisticated.
Right. It can be done under color of elections. I mean, it can be done the way that McCain said, right? If you kick out the current bunch of advisors, since Obama is such a lightweight, since he's passive and timid and, detached from a lot of these things, doesn't really understand very much. In that sense, a very bad choice, as I tried to argue. However, Obama is not the main warmonger anymore, and this is very important for people to understand. Obama is far from being the lesser evil. He has been surpassed in evil by neocons and indeed by these humanitarian bombers, right? The people like Samantha Power and Kerry and others. And you can say, why did he appoint them? Well, that gets us back to the idea that the American president is normally a puppet, unless he makes tremendous efforts to assert himself, which Obama is incapable of doing. He's going to be a puppet. And some of the stuff I talk about, right? You think that Obama knows the details of what we've just gone through? I sincerely doubt it. I think in many cases, he's lucky if he's told after the fact when these things are done. But the idea is this. You look at Benghazi. What was Benghazi? It was a coup. That was a coup under color of election. That was, I call it an October surprise in the era of early voting. You can't have an October surprise in October anymore because too many votes have been cast, right? You don't get the full effect. So you got to have your October surprise in September. That's Benghazi. What was it? Designed to get Obama out and Romney in. Why Romney? Because he had surrounded himself with the neocons. Right, these people who are, they're hysterical to get back in power. They want to get back on the inside, and vindicate themselves by starting new wars.
But it didn't work, Webster. It didn't work.
No, it didn't work. It didn't work partly because of the stupidity of Romney. He was so inept, right? Such a fool, so tone deaf that he couldn't do it. Then you look at this Bergdahl, right? What's with Bergdahl? We had 4,000 to 5,000 people killed in Iraq, right? And we've never really had a full investigation of that, right? That's never been sufficiently clarified. But now we have 4 people dead in Libya. That's the end of the world. And then Bergdahl and these Taliban supermen, right? Apparently these people have magical powers. And once you let them out, then there's no stopping them, right? Nothing can stand against them. It's ridiculous. So you look at Benghazi, Bergdahl. These are attempts to get hysteria going. And I would point to another thing. The American president is controlled by Wall Street. In the first term, Wall Street controls the presidency by the need for money to run a campaign to get reelected. That's very clear. In the second term, since the 2-term limit has been put in, very bad idea, but the Republicans did it because they hated Roosevelt so much. Since then, though, the second term, the president has to be controlled by scandals. That's Watergate, that's Iran-Contra, that's Clinton-gate, Monica Lewinsky, and so forth. And now with Obama, it's an attempt to get a series of scandals to control him. But make no mistake, the entity that's doing this is Wall Street and the banking community.
We got to wrap up here very quickly, though. What are the odds we have U.S. NATO forces on the ground in Iraq before year's end?
They're increasing. And here's the one thing I would recommend. If you want to do something about this stuff, there are two things. If you're in New York, you got to look at Randy Credico for governor. He's trying to get on the Democratic ballot to challenge Cuomo, the Wall Street.
Got
to
wrap it up here, Webster.
In Nebraska, you've got Dan Burdorf against Ben Sasse.
All right, Webster Tarpley, thanks as always. Tarpley.net, the website. Appreciate it. Thank you. When we come back, the healing technologies of Nikola Tesla, right here on Coast to Coast. My name is Richard Serrett.